KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in San Rafael, California.
I'm from San Jose,
Hayward, California.
Nopa.
Kind of lower Russian Hill.
I live across from El Metate in San Francisco.
Coming up, the story behind the wild noises you might be hearing at Lake Merritt in Oakland.
Yeah, so that would be the adults screeching, and then the kick, 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 kick. Those are the chicks.
Then we'll get a kite's eye view of the Bay Area's vibrant salt ponds and marshes.
It's a landscape that's changing from the very exuberant colors of salt making, the bright greens, to more natural tones.
And we'll take a trip off the coast to hear the sounds of a sea life sanctuary.
See how the little chick has a little rhino horn nubbin at the base of its bill? The adults grow like a full little horn that they have during the breeding season.
Today's Cross Currents is going to be wild. Take a walk around Lake Merritt right now, and you might hear some strange noises. This is the second year in a row of Oakland's great heron experiment. This time last year, KALW science reporter Marissa Ortega-Welch headed to Lake Merritt to capture the sounds and scene. Today, we're hearing more about the experiment in this story from our archives.
It's a sunny day at Lake Merritt, and biologist Steven Peterson is up in a tree testing a speaker. It's playing a recording of herons.
Yeah, so that would be the adults screeching, and then the kick, 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 kick. Those are the chicks. Those would be the chicks. So if you've ever been over by the rookery over there in downtown Oakland, this is what it sounds like.
In fact, he's trying to lure the birds who've nested in downtown Oakland for years to come nest at this spot at Lake Merritt instead. A little down the lakeshore, I watch an arborist lifted up to the tree canopy in a cherry picker. Another arborist climbs up into the branches of a different tree. Biologist Kevin Cahill is down below, surrounded by a pile of boxes filled with bird nests.
Tying a rope onto this box here.
To send up to the guys in the tree, who take out the sticks, the very sticks herons used last year to build their nest downtown.
And basically build a new nest for these guys and gals.
Developers got permission to remove the nests to make way for two new apartment buildings. In exchange, they hired this team of biologists to try and relocate the bird rookery to Lake Merritt.
One sec!
Hence the bird recordings, the nest relocation, and fake birds.
They made it nice and tight for me. See, it's got kind of some, like a metal post for the legs. The legs are painted pink.
A black-crowned night heron. It's a foot-tall, gray-blue bird with a long neck and long legs for wading in the water. These are decoys. Herons are social. They want to nest with other herons. So if the real birds see these decoys in the tree, the hope is that they'll come join them to nest.
If I was a heron, I'd probably want to come over and check it out, you know, if I was flying by. What about you? What do you think?
I'm impressed. Yeah, I think it looks really good.
I've been waiting for this moment for a long time. I used to work at Golden Gate Audubon Society, a local bird conservation organization, which pushed the city to require the developers to attempt this relocation project when we learned that the trees were going to get cut down. For years now, two species of birds, black-crowned night herons and snowy egrets, have taken to nesting in downtown Oakland. These herons are sort of like the raccoons of the bird world. They don't seem to mind living around people, and they especially like the large ficus trees all over downtown, like the ones in the parking lot by the post office.
There were these nests filling up all these street trees on the block.
That's Cindy Margulis, executive director of Golden Gate Audubon Society and my former boss.
It was noisy, and there was a lot of poop.
It was wild. Nature right in the city, the largest black-crowned night heron rookery in the Bay Area. But things came to a head a few years ago.
So in 2014, the U.S. Post Office branch downtown Oakland, they ordered a tree cut at the wrong time of the year when the herons were nesting because they didn't want the herons pooping on their postal trucks.
Four young birds had to be taken to rehab. It was a wake-up call for the Audubon staff. Some people found these herons to be a nuisance. Wilderness in the city is not always pretty.
So the young birds can fall out of the trees. They can also push out their siblings sometimes.
It's part of nature. But what's not part of nature? Concrete and cars. In a more natural environment, soft duff or mud cushions baby birds' falls, and bushes act like stepladders for birds to get back into nests.
So it was pretty gruesome. You would see birds dying or already dead laying on the street.
Golden Gate Audubon knew it had to get involved. It was my job to train volunteers to monitor the nests. The docents came out almost every day to walk the streets of downtown Oakland and look for baby birds that had fallen out of trees and were hiding at the bus stop, under parked cars.
I'm sure our docents looked ridiculous with their heads underneath wheel wells in the parking lot.
Then they'd call the Oakland Zoo to come out and rescue the birds. The birds did not go quietly.
The bird's gonna scream, and it actually has a scream that's very much like a dinosaur, and it looks a little bit like a dinosaur too.
Zookeepers transferred the birds to the International Bird Rescue Center, where the birds stayed until they were able to fly. Then they were released out into marshes around the bay. Much better habitat. This went on for 2 years. Then Audubon staff learned the main heron nesting spots were slated for development. The trees that the post office once trimmed were now going to get cut down. Audubon's Cindy Margulis felt torn.
I was struggling with how do we protect these birds? But obviously that is not the best place for them to be because we knew we were having to rescue so many of those birds.
And she didn't want to stand in the way of development.
Housing is a shortage for people in downtown Oakland. So we totally understand that those developments are needed. So the question was, how can we do right for people and right for birds all in one fell swoop?
Margulis pushed the city of Oakland to require the developers to try and relocate the nesting herons. And to her surprise, they agreed. I have to say, I've wondered whether this was all worth it. Heron populations are doing fine in the Bay Area, at least right now. What if we spend all this time and money and it doesn't work?
It is a science experiment. There's no doubt about that. But it's based on good science. And in this case, the financial burden is actually being borne by the developers.
Ray Connell is the development manager for the building going up on 14th Street. When his company, Holland Partner Group, bought the property, he immediately Googled the herons. The first thing he read was about the incident with the post office.
That was a red flag. I figured we could not do it. Whatever we did, we could not do that.
He drove around the site, but it was winter before nesting season, and he didn't see any of the birds.
Fast forward about 6 weeks later, I saw the influx of all the herons coming to roost.
Connell says the relocation is costing his company and the other developer more than $200,000. And I just wonder, why would you buy a building that came with so many strings or birds attached?
As a developer, you would say, oh, you know, because we get to build apartments and that's great for us. But it's actually a really great thing for the city and for the birds because now they're in a place where hopefully they'll go to a place where they can actually thrive. And we won't have, you know, 70 plus birds, baby birds falling out of trees and getting hit by cars and falling on top of the post office vehicles.
Connell takes me on a walk around the development lot.
It's going to be 262 apartment units. It's going to be 7 stories.
The trees on his property are gone, but herons still live in the trees across the street.
Yeah, you can see them up in there. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Kind of looking down at us, looking, trying to see what we're doing.
What happens if all the herons who lost their nests just spread out to other trees around downtown? How will Connell feel after his company has put in all this work and all this money?
Yeah, we really do want it to work, and yeah, I think down at the lake will be a much better place for them. Yeah, it'll be a little disheartening, but hopefully, you know, over time, they'll move back to the lake. That's the goal.
For Cross Currents, I'm Marissa Ortega Welch in Oakland.
Marissa is KALW's science reporter. Connect with her at science@kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hanna Baba. Almost everyone who flies into San Francisco or San Jose Airport has seen it. A vibrant patchwork quilt of colorful water. There on the southern edge of the bay, you could see bright pinks, pumpkin oranges, neon greens, and deep magentas, contrasted against the dark blues of the natural bay water. The last time KALW listener Donna Staten peered out an airplane window, she saw it too.
When the plane takes that right-hand turn and goes up the bay, at the southern end of the bay, there's a lot of bizarre colors and squares, and some are big white squares on the water, and some are pink squares on the water, and a lot of the water looks brown, and it just made me wonder, what is all that, and why doesn't the bay have a more natural coastline at the southern end?
Well, she asked us here at KALW, and we sent out environment reporter Angela Johnston to tell us more.
To get the best view of what Donna's talking about, it helps to have a kite. Just ask kite aerial photographer Chris Benton. You can find him here at the Baylands most weekends, talking to his kite like a pet as he slowly coaxes it up into the air.
There we go. I'm going to send it up, I think, just a little bit higher. There we go. And it's just absolutely wonderful holding this line and being connected to this big invisible mass of air that's floating past us. Very satisfying.
Benton's kite is blue and white with a long tail that looks like a red feather boa. But the really cool thing about it is how he can fasten a digital camera to the line and send it up hundreds of feet in the air to snap pictures below.
When I first started photographing down here, it was largely an intoxication with the sort of color and texture of the place.
That was over a decade ago when Benton took a sabbatical from his job as an architecture professor at Berkeley to work with a microbiologist. The biologist photographed the Bay Area landscape from his microscope, and Benton captured the same area from above. One day, they came here, on the water's edge of the South Bay.
And I was immediately taken. Such a visually exuberant landscape. And now this is 10 years later, and I'm still photographing.
This visually exuberant landscape, the reds and the corals and deep oranges outlined with bright white borders, they look like they could be natural. But the colorful squares are man-made salt ponds, engineered to extract and harvest salt from the salinity of the bay water. All 8,000 acres of ponds are now managed by a company named Cargill.
Cargill's harvesting about 600 tons of salt here in the South Bay. You can see the big stack of salt down in Newark. It's the one remaining salt plant.
The mud and the Mediterranean climate make it a great place to harvest salt from the water. A handful of family-owned businesses kickstarted the industry over a century ago, before they were all bought up by Cargill.
These are the remnants, really, of what is still an active enterprise, the evaporation of bay water to produce salt. Salt for industrial use and sometimes for the culinary use.
Salt for icy roads, salt for pretzels, and salt that eventually sits on your dining room table, after it's been cleaned up, of course. You can find it under the brand name Diamond Crystal. Salt making is a pretty simple process. Slightly salty bay water flows into one pond, and then gravity does its magic. The salt water works its way from pond to pond to pond, and as it does, it gets saltier and saltier through evaporation.
Those are colors related to the salinity of the salt ponds, and they're produced by microorganisms.
As the water gets saltier, fewer things can survive in it, and that's why we get those magenta and bright pink colors. Only a few types of algae and bacteria can bear the saltiest of ponds. They're called halophiles, salt lovers. And these salt lovers tend to be pretty colorful.
So each band of salinity will host one or two types of halophiles. They go through a whole range of greens. And reds and oranges and yellows.
Photographer Chris Benton moves the camera with a radio airplane controller. He walks around the Baylands for hours, adjusting the camera and taking photos every other second, sometimes running back and forth to make sure the camera doesn't fall into the water. He likes to use a kite because it can go high enough in the air to give perspective, but low enough to notice changes in the landscape, changes away from commercial salt.
What I'm trying to do is capture the transition we're experiencing today, which is as rapid and dramatic, really, as almost anything that's happened before. Going in a happy direction, too.
As part of a huge effort called the South Bay Salt Pond Restoration Project, the Cargill Salt Company has freed almost 16,000 acres of their salt ponds.
We stopped making salt and we started managing for wildlife instead.
Cheryl Strong is a biologist with the project. I meet her at the Don Edwards National Wildlife Refuge in Fremont, a spot where a lot of this restoration work is happening. We walk up a hill and peer down at salt ponds in the midst of transformation, back into their natural state, marshland. The process, like making salt, is also really simple.
Literally going in with an excavator and cutting a hole through the levee.
Allowing the tide to come in and out twice a day like it does naturally.
And as it comes in, it brings in sediment, it brings in seeds, and that's how you start to build your marsh.
It takes a bit more planning for the ponds that have walking trails along the levees or power towers running through them. But otherwise, it's pretty easy.
By the tide coming in and out, it's sort of doing it for free for you, right?
Take, for example, a salt pond the project opened up to the tides in 2006. Workers dug open the levees with a backhoe and watched nature do its work.
It is already growing a massive amount of native tidal marsh within it, and we already have our two endangered species using that pond in less than 10 years. So that was like a huge success story and happened much faster than we thought it would.
So far, the project has restored about half a dozen salt ponds in the South Bay, with three more coming in the next 5 years. In response, Bay Area-specific species like the salt marsh harvest mouse and a bird called the Ridgeway rail have bounced back. Another bonus, says Cheryl Strong, protection from sea level rise.
Silicon Valley is built up against these salt ponds, and they are currently providing some level of flood protection, but they are not flood protection levees. If we can get some tidal marsh built out in front of those ponds or turn some of those ponds back into tidal marsh, they will provide a much better buffer for sea level rise as we see those sea levels increase.
But as these areas transform from salt pond to marsh, the vibrant colors change too.
You're going to see a lot more natural blues and greens on the landscape because we don't have that end result of high salinity water at the end.
Photographer Chris Benton witnesses this change from the camera on his kite.
I won't say to my dismay as a photographer, but to my slight regret as a photographer, it's a landscape that's changing from the very exuberant colors of salt making, the bright greens and fuchsias and oranges and reds, to more natural tones as salt making gives way to restored marsh.
Moving towards the green marshland that once carpeted most of the South Bay. And he's okay with that. And so is Donna Staten, our listener who asked about the salt ponds.
I'm not sad. I think trying to protect natural wetlands is above all going to be most important for us going down the road. So people can take pictures now and we can look at them in books and online, but the natural habitat will probably be much better off in its natural state.
In the South Bay, for Cross Currents, I'm Angela Johnston.
That story originally aired in 2017. Angela is KALW's environment reporter. Drop her a line at environment@kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hannah Baba. And now it's time for an audiograph, the signature sounds of the Bay Area. We've been exploring the bay's landscape and a lot of the creatures that inhabit it. Now we're going to take you offshore for a rare glimpse at a sanctuary for seabirds.
We are about to ride in a 14-foot Zodiac, well, it's actually an Achilles, inflatable boat over to Onyenuevo Island.
Jesse Beck is our captain on today's inflatable boat commute.
I'm a biologist with Oikonos Ecosystem Knowledge, which is a nonprofit in Santa Cruz, California.
Right now, we're loading the boat with supplies like food, fuel, and sleeping bags. That's because Jesse and three other biologists are spending the next 2 days studying the seabirds on Onyenuevo Island, which is otherwise closed to the public. I'm only allowed to come along and record if I help them.
I'll get in our places.
Jesse's special project is conserving the rhinoceros auklet, a relative of the puffin. These birds dig burrows for their nests with their feet and a little horn on their bill, which is how they get their name. Onyenuevo Island is one of their few nesting places in the United States, so we're all zipped tightly into wetsuits and crashing through waves in this tiny boat. This conservation project is funded by money the government puts aside to fix ecological disasters caused by oil spills. In this case, the Lucanbach oil spill. The Lucanbach is a ship that smashed into another vessel off the coast of San Francisco and sank in 1953. It had nearly 500,000 gallons of fuel in the hull, and when the sunken hull rusted out in the 90s, it started belching oil into the water. That killed a bunch of marine life, including almost 600 rhinoceros auklets. Double the current population of Onyenuevo Island.
The beach is called the Landing Cove, and it's where we land all of our boats.
High swells nearly flood the small boat's motor, so it's a relief when we arrive at the island.
There's going to be a lot of nesting gulls. Right now, all their eggs are hatching into chicks, and so they're going to defend those chicks to the maximum by pecking us on the head, hitting us on the head, and pooping all over our jackets.
That explains the raincoat they give me. We climb up some rocks and a ladder to get onto the island. It's small, just a little bigger than Alcatraz. Unrelenting wind and the cacophony of bird cries hits us in full force. The rocky landscape is studded with nests. We could be on another planet.
Take a handful of these. We're gonna make a little path.
That's Ryan Carl. He manages the restoration project with Jesse. We're deep in bird territory, so he's building a path winding through fragile nests and scouting for vulnerable chicks.
The gulls really don't like it when you get near their chicks. That hurt.
Ow! Damn it!
Jerk bird.
Western gulls nest on the ground above rhinoceros auklet burrows. They're literally on top of each other, and they don't get along. Gulls sometimes eat auklets.
This one right here is the mean one.
Dive bombing us. Hurts.
The paths we make will keep birds safe tonight when researchers are walking around the island in the dark. We'll be mist netting, catching birds in big, gauzy nets, kind of like tennis nets, but harder to see.
The mist nets are going to go like right here is going to be one, and then there's going to be two going this way.
We're specifically looking at the rhinoceros auklets and what they eat.
So the auklets are going to be coming in at night with fish in their bills to feed their chicks. And we want to catch them as they're coming in, and then we're going to get those fish as a diet sample.
Rhinoceros auklets are some of the only birds that bring back whole fish, which is the gold standard of a seabird diet sample. This way, scientists can tell exactly which species the birds are catching.
Are we all ready?
The nets bloom outwards on the wind and flutter. They're almost invisible in the twilight. It's no wonder the birds fly into them. I can barely see them, and I know where to look.
So Claire, I'm going to need you at the banding station, like, basically as soon as the first bird hits.
It's almost 10 o'clock and pretty dark, but we see the first bird hit the net. He thrashes. Tenderly, a researcher pulls him out and brings him up to where Ryan and I are recording data.
Fish. Thorough check.
Stick its head in there. What, net? Net three?
Net three, yes.
Thanks.
When we get a bird, we check to see if it has a band, then log the time we caught it and whether or not it carried fish. The next bird doesn't have a band, so Ryan gently wraps one around his leg.
It's a stainless steel band, and I'm just closing it down with pliers. It's super simple. They just each have their own number and put it on their right foot always.
California is different from most other states in how it takes stock of ecological disasters, like the Leuchenbach spill. In this case, California is replacing not only the auklet mortalities, but total auklet years lost. What that means is when one bird dies, the ecosystem also loses the potential of the chicks that bird might have raised if it lived longer. There's a lot of complicated math to project what the colony would have looked like if the disaster never happened. When the oil started spilling in the 90s, only 19 chicks were surviving per year. Now the colony is so healthy that last season's count was 96 new chicks. More than the researchers even hoped.
I'll show you how to release it.
Okay, let's do it.
I cradle the auklet against my stomach, a small warmth against my larger one. The bluff is a maze of nests that drops off suddenly to the ocean below. Thick, angry shadows of gulls swirl above, diving down to peck at my head. I crouch to release the small bird. He staggers towards the edge in the red light of my lamp, raises his wings, and seems to vanish into the shrieking black sky. On Año Nuevo Island, I'm Claire Strumpel for Cross Currents.
Birds of a feather, we rock together. And if we got a problem, we talk together. So let's head down south, escape the bad weather. Ooh, ooh.
That story originally aired in 2017 when Claire was a student in our audio academy. Now she's running a news department in Haines, Alaska. Are you interested in learning how to make radio? We're here to help you do it. We're currently accepting applications for our next audio academy, which will run from September through June. It's pretty amazing. Find more information at kalw.org. We're listening to Brand New Heartache from Oakland. They're performing at the New Parish in their hometown tomorrow night. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.
I'll be home when I see her again. But for now, you're drunk and fools are my only friends. So what do you say? Let's be part.